Hi, everyone. Welcome to another exciting episode of Bloomberg Intelligence's Tech Disruptors podcast. My name is Anurag Rana, and I'm a technology analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, Bloomberg's in-house research arm. We're delighted to have the Chief Technology Officer of Zendesk, Adrian McDermott, as our guest today. Cloud remains the single biggest disrupting factor in the software space, and Zendesk has been growing much faster than the overall industry. So without any delay, let's ask Adrian about the various areas he's focused on. So to start off, Adrian, perhaps you can start with a brief history of Zendesk.
Absolutely. Yeah. Zendesk is a customer experience software company, and our goal really is to make it easy for companies to create connections with their customers. It was founded in Copenhagen in Denmark in 2007. I joined around 2010 in San Francisco after the company had moved to North America. And today we power over 1 billion conversations. So we have about 100,000 customers around the world. And I've really focused on meeting with those customers, making connections and growing the company. I also grew product development from about 10 engineers to 1,500. And the company reached $1 billion in revenue in 2021 and IPO'd in 2014.
And, you know, you did mention the customer relationship area. Now, that's an area that has been, you know, I guess, been disrupted for a while. So how should we think of Zendesk disrupting that particular market? I mean, largely because it has been around for, I would say, over 20 years now.
Yeah, or more. I think if we think back to the original call centers in bunkers with agents reading scripts and sort of being in control of the conversation with consumers when they dial in, I think the founders of Zendesk were actually out in Denmark implementing that kind of traditional legacy on-premise customer service software. And they felt like there must be something better. They looked at what was going on in the consumer web and ultimately thought to themselves, well, there's a couple of things we could do here to make this available to everybody without having these giant consulting projects and, you know, kind of long-term budgets. Firstly, the idea that you could democratize customer service software and make it accessible for all. So have it available on the web, have a free trial, have the products really work, you know, quote unquote, out of the box. And that's the second really, I think, secret sauce of Zendesk is we do take a position on how customer support should be done. To grow an SMB business, I think you have to be a little bit educational in your position and in helping people really understand, you know, we all, you know, or company founders, you know, small business owners, medium, you know, commercial business owners, we all have like day jobs to do. And those jobs generally in businesses like that are not specifically customer service. All businesses should be about serving their customers, but, you know, the three-person bike shop, the gas station in Texas, which I think there was a small chain that was really the first American customer for Zendesk that anonymously signed up on the web. These folks were trying to, you know, respond to emails, serve their customers. And I think the disruptive nature of Zendesk kind of democratizing access to world-class software and then, you know, laying out with 8 triggers and an automation in the product, how customer support should be done, what the rhythm of customer service is, how it should be managed, how you should respond to your customers, these kind of things, bringing best practices from the industry to everybody. I think that really changed the game. At the time, you know, customer service was not super cool. Zendesk was actually rejected for the TechCrunch Disrupt conference because they thought it was boring. No one was interested in customer service. I think we've come a long way from that.
Now, one of the things you did mention just now, the SMB space, now that's an area where I think you specialize, but perhaps you could give us some breakdown of, you know, your customer layout as to how do you define the SMB space? How do you define the enterprise space? Is that the only area you focus on, or how do people go up market? So perhaps, you know, give us a bit of information on your customer breakdown.
We have over 100,000 customers, and we've been kind of growing and moving up market for a long time. That was really sort of the rationale behind the use of funds from the IPO in 2014. And I think we've been moving up market and spreading geographically around the world pretty constantly. So one statistic that we share is that customers that spend greater than $1 million ARR, annual recurring revenue, with Zendesk that number is up 65% year over year for us. So we're seeing, I think partly as a pandemic side effect, we're seeing companies wanting rapid time to value, products that work out of the box without sort of the need for long lead times and large professional services implementations. across the industry. So characteristically, I think SMBs are our core market and where we began. I think, you know, they value that idea of how long does it take before I'm serving tickets, serving customers, right? The time to first ticket served is this key metric. I think what we've found in the enterprise space as it morphs and expectations changes, the way that buyers now think about software and look at software is it really should be more fit for purpose than perhaps in the past, where there was an idea that, you know, implementation times could be longer. It, you know, the product was more of a toolkit and didn't work out of the box. And so our strength really, I think, in the move into enterprise, or one of our strengths, has been taking that immediacy of implementation and marrying it to, you know, the best of web services, SDKs, and beyond, and being able to work, whether it's our SDKs for Unity and Discord, an integration to Discord for the gaming center, our integrations into Shopify and other retail platforms for retail or beyond. Our goal is to have as much coverage as possible and do as much of the heavy lifting as possible for our customers.
So let me, you know, stick with something you just talked about, the pandemic. Now, we also cover the likes of Shopify and DocuSign and then Salesforce mm-hmm. and a bunch of other software companies. And then one of the criticism I get quite a bit is that, you know, the pandemic pulled forward a lot of demand for a lot of the software industry, and perhaps the growth over the next few years is not going to be as good. And when you hear that criticism or, you know, comments, how do you respond to them about, you know, the end markets or the pull forward of demand and where things could be over the next few years?
You know, it's certainly across 100,000 customers. I think we saw some, you know, many of SMBs obviously like basically shut down or went into hibernation as a result of the pandemic. And then we had a whole other classes of customers that experienced massive rapid growth that they could barely keep up with. You know, we found ourselves adding servers for food delivery customers back in the cloud, you know, buying capacity from Amazon just to keep up with the massive spikes in demand. And so it evened out around the world. I think as we go into the sort of, if we can be so bold, the post-pandemic world, I think, and we're also heading obviously into crypto and non-crypto recession, I think what we can see that focus on the customer is becoming more important. So in the generalized software industry, I think some segments perhaps are going to struggle, but, you know, the pandemic has changed consumer expectations around what to expect from customer service from businesses, which for us has heightened the importance of what we do, right? 61% of customers would defect to a competitor after one bad experience. That's a 22% jump up from last year, according, you know, based on Zendesk data. And with two negative experiences, 76% of customers are looking for an alternative. And people know how to find alternatives, right? The web has become this effective, democratized storefront that everyone is using. So I think today's business leaders, whether it's SMB, commercial, enterprise, I think they definitely see that the front line, the coal face of their business, is the place where they talk to customers. And for us, that means that, you know, we're somewhat inured from the downturn, because keeping your customers, maintaining lifetime value of customers, is an existential problem for so many businesses in a recession, which is, you know, while I'm not going to claim we're recession proof, certainly is a healthy spur for growth for the Zendesk business.
No, that's a fair point. And, you know, that's the whole thing with the SMBs, that during a recession, there is a problem, or there is, you know, I would say, you know, businesses do go out, the smaller businesses do go out of business. And so perhaps, you know, from that in mind, you know, when you look at the growth drivers for the company going forward, you know, is international expansion one of them, or is it increasing more revenue per customers from your existing base? Because the funnel by itself will have some issues logically if we do go into a recession.
I agree. I think that, you know, it's a characteristic of SMB-dominated businesses that they are strong, their performance actually is strongly tied or correlated to the macro environment, right? I think that's the nature of SMB. And so if you're going to have some kind of hedge against that, it has to be into other segments. Firstly, you know, we're translated into, I think, over 40 languages, and we have traditionally had a huge international presence, Asia and Europe. And I think this has been one of the ways that we've dealt with surges or economic problems in various areas. Secondly, the majority of growth for Zendesk, I think in the long term, if we're going to maintain 30% plus growth, is going to come from a simultaneous move up market as we expand internationally, right? I mentioned the growth in million plus ARR customers, but it is clear that the larger projects for us, the larger deals, and the more significant place that we're investing in technology and building partnerships with system integrators and beyond is in the enterprise space, because it's a rich vein. We're still seeing, you know, cloud, that there's still a generation of cloud replacement to happen, where people who pulled copper into the back of the contact center system are thinking about, well, what is my move to digital? And companies without a strong digital presence are thinking to themselves, what is my digital storefront, or designing the digital connection point for customers, where there's an expectation that, you know, customers, whatever the business, B2C, B2B, and, you know, we should talk about the surge in business to employee growth as well in digital interaction. I think the digital transformers, the digital adopters, and now thinking, well, where can I begin talking to my customers and connecting with them, offering self-service alternatives, because we have issues with the great resignation, we have issues staffing. I think that those factors and those changes in the way that people connect with customers, employees, citizens, are driving a lot of our growth in the enterprise.
I completely am on board with that. That's the trend we're seeing in some of the other software companies as well. So perhaps now let's, you know, stick to CX in, you know, this is an area where, again, I would say has been around for a little bit. So perhaps let's talk a little bit about the product roadmap, that when you first started, how was the product defined at that time, and how have you, you know, kind of naturally progressed things to take into account things like AI or conversation? What have some of the, I would say, the marquee product developments that you have seen, and what are some of the other areas that now you're working on as we look forward?
So I think when I started, you know, we were focused on adding the capabilities of a CX platform and making sure it was rounded out, right? There's, as we mentioned, a significant amount of prior art in space from contact center vendors and beyond. And there was an expansion of the channels that were required. In 2014, we built our own chat implementation. Or in 2013, in 2014, we actually, to accelerate that movement, acquired a chat company. And then in, I think, you know, 2020, we bought a messaging platform to go beyond. So the industry has moved in some ways from session-based chat to long-running conversational CRM. At the same time, you know, efficiency is incredibly important, and especially in conversational platforms, AI can be a huge bolster to the interaction. And so right now, we've gone beyond just kind of thinking about how do we add channels, how do we add capabilities, how do we add reporting, into how do we build the best, how do we help our customers build the best customer experiences that connect with their customers. And I think there's a couple of key tenets that we are extremely bullish on. The first, conversational CRM. So in our personal daily lives, right, we connect over Messenger, we connect over, you know, Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp, if you're international, all of these kind of tools. They're the way that we communicate the majority of the time. I think innovative brands, an example, Zendesk customer would perhaps be the Four Seasons Resorts, realize that it was the way that customers preferred to connect, right? It's lower calorie, lower impact than a voice call or a voice conversation, which is by definition kind of a synchronous experience that takes the majority of your focus. A messaging conversation, you can have casually, you can come back in, come out. It can be asynchronous or synchronous. And we see, you know, consumers, old, young, international, et cetera, using this form of communication significantly. Now, you know, businesses that really began to embrace this also began to see that the messaging channel itself was becoming basically the web, the storefront, right? There's rich interactivity in web and mobile that can be embedded within conversation. I think, you know, WeChat in China really led the way here, where it became the place not just for the conversation, but for the storefront, for the application, it became sort of the internet within the internet, and development was really happening there. I think we've been a little slower to adopt that, but you know, Zendesk customers, OpenTable, Logitech, Four Seasons, et cetera, everyone is thinking about, well, how can I move from just having a conversation, which is sort of like basically moving the ticket from voice to chat to email to eventually ending up in messaging? How do I go beyond that, where the messaging window lets me actually, you know, book the massage at the Four Seasons, order room service through the application without leaving it? And I think when we see great experiences, great conversational platform experiences like that, I think what we're seeing there to a certain extent is the future of digital customer service, right? It's extremely convenient for the consumer, and you can embed so much self-service into that messaging application. We acquired a communication platform as a service, a CPaaS, Zoom. It's based in Montreal a couple of years ago because we felt like this was a key, this is going to be a key capability for product, for customer experience products in the future. And we've been investing heavily in the R&D. Second, I think key movement in our opinion and change and disruption in the industry in some ways is artificial intelligence, right? I think we're entering perhaps a new era in AI where, you know, cynically one could say it's moving from not working that well to actually really working quite well, right? AI, you know, it could be broadly divided into three stages. Artificial narrow intelligence, right? The ability to perform specific, simple, perhaps complex tasks that really just models that do one thing, do it reasonably well. We're moving into sort of more of a general intelligence thing where the models are large and applicable to many different categories of problem. And that transition from first stage to second stage, I think, has taken a really long time, from basic machine learning to more generalized intelligence, right? Good enough to fool a Google engineer, as we like to say. But we're sort of on the cusp of completing that transition. I think artificial and super intelligence is probably some way off and less applicable in some ways to customer service, but there's definitely accelerated progress in artificial intelligence, and it can be applied to CX, right? The, you know, large language models, you know, the ability to do deep learning, increased accuracy, use case, data and parameters, right? And so much of the great privately developed technology becoming public, really changing the game for companies like Zendesk, where we're not going to do massive primal for, you know, first research or build out some of these capabilities, but we can stand on the shoulders of giants, and that's the beauty of open source that allows us to do that. So we're really thinking about now AI in a CX world.
I have personally been using this quite a bit, and one of the things always amazes me is how I'm able to get a lot of the questions answered just ahead of time without even, you know, getting to a physical human being. Do you have any information you could share that, you know, out of the incoming tickets, what portion of them gets resolved by this automated system versus what actually goes to a, you know, a human?
Well, the percentage is people deploy high quality bots, use large language models to get better understanding. The percentage is growing rapidly. Our opinion and prediction is that by 2030 at the latest, AI will replace 75% of frontline customer interactions, right? Whatever those interactions are, it's progressed dramatically over the years. Like, there are extraordinary products, right? Products that look, you know, one of my favorites is a product that looks at the incoming area code of a user and then morphs the agent's voice to have the accent of that area. You know, so the agent could be in Estonia speaking in a Tennessee accent to a customer because of the area code. Extraordinary technology that's available. And I think the way that bots can automate interactions is becoming, you know, while still clearly not perfect, it's just becoming so significant. I think for Zendesk, we've been implementing, you know, fairly carefully for a while. Like, originally our goal was to take models and kind of, you know, respond to customers and do things. Now, I would say that, you know, this was almost the party trick era of machine learning for Zendesk, right? Where we could predict, you know, the user sentiment of a ticket. So we have sentiment prediction where given an incoming interaction, we could say, there's a 75% chance that you get a bad satisfaction rating here. You can route tickets with that, use it as a training opportunity, these kind of things. We were able to like sort of answer customers using our platform, and we have a capability called AnswerBot. And that could understand, you know, basically what someone was looking for, the intersection of concepts or entities within the ticket, and then use a model that if your ticket volume or if your interaction volume was under 400 a week, we'd use kind of a vector-based search index to respond. If it was over that, we could use reinforced learning techniques to make it better and better and better. As we think about it now, I think what we're building is we're moving from the party trick era to the platform era, where I think using today's AI capabilities, including some that we acquired with a company called Cleverly, we're able to look at every interaction and say, you know, this is the language, identifying up to 146 languages. This is the intent. This is what the person is trying to do. And this is the sentiment of this user, which can be incredibly important in routing, you know, like understanding who to deal with the ticket, how quickly it gets dealt with, these kind of things, the priority. And so from an intent point of view, you know, we're building models now for industry specific applications. So like the e-commerce model, the tech model, the FinServe model, because, you know, the average customer service implementation probably has, you know, 50 to a few hundred questions that they actually answer. Like, or, you know, in retail, it's like a return, credit card update, product not working, blah, blah. Like these are the outcomes. These are the actions. And I think using AI, you can bring in any ticket and model and map it to one of those 100, 200 actions if you understand the problem space, and become really, really good at predicting what the user is looking for, whether this needs an agent or could be handled automatically, whether the user should be able to self-serve and process the return themselves in the chat window, whether they need something else. I think this is really exciting because, you know, employees, people for customer service, they, you know, they're not becoming cheaper and they're not becoming more plentiful. And so we need to automate as much of this as possible where it is automatable, and then make sure that we're escalating to humans for the things that require humans, for the human interactive tasks, for the things where the sentiment is such that a conversation is needed, and be able to understand and triage those interactions. I think that's the true promise of AI in customer service.
Well, it is excellent. I mean, I, as I said, I have been using this quite a bit over the last 12 months, and I have seen it become fairly sophisticated. Now, one thing I don't know is who's powering the technology, you know, behind the scenes. And with that in mind, I would love to learn from you, you know, who would be your major competitors out there in the cloud world? And also, you know, what portion of, I would say, either contact center or the CX market do you think is still on-premise, where I guess the end market is very good for all of you?
From a competitor point of view, there are a series of incumbent large-scale providers, right? So, you know, there's the Salesforces for B2B, there's the ServiceNows for B2C, for business to employee kind of IT implementations. And then there's a lot of competitors in, I think, B2C that are happening. And then there are the traditional contact center vendors. And so Zendesk has integrations with like 36 traditional contact center vendors. And I think that, you know, there's still plenty of business for us, especially around the world, which the Cisco box that's wired in, right? The original on-premise implementation of, say, Genesys or something else. And so I think that, you know, the digital transformation industry, as you like, is still moving very quickly and still very relevant as companies feel the need to go digital. And so I think that, you know, that could be as high as 40% of our business, but I think it's 40% that could sustain itself for many years to come, just because of the perceived, anyway, in the market cost of converting from on-prem implementations into and moving into the cloud and basically redesigning the digital experience for customers.
So now perhaps just within AI itself, you know, are there any breakthroughs that's going to do more, I guess, take the conversational AI concept to a different level? Are there, you know, areas that your team is working on that would give you some new flavors or functionalities down the road? If you have any in the mind, you know, would love to hear what we can expect over the next few years.
Yeah, I think a big focus, you know, right now is leveraging the AI platform that we're building for our core, you know, user personas. And there are basically two user personas in customer service that really matter. The first is obviously the end user. We've talked a little bit about how, you know, the primary job of AI really has to be to create interactions that are enjoyable for customers, right? You know, I think 60+% of customers prefer really to have a bot interaction or are comfortable having a bot interaction. There's a perception that it's more efficient. I think it sounds like you share that perception. When it works well, it's very convenient, very low calorie, and it's really enjoyable. And I think so one part of our focus, we have a product called AnswerBot Flows that we've recently launched and have been building, is to democratize the ability to create that kind of bot where you're mapping, you know, you're firstly, A, discovering the intent of the users automatically and capturing the information about them, identifying them, which is extremely important, right? Think back to the days of customer service where the first script was, can I get your, you know, can I get your name? Can I get your email? Can I get your username? You can short circuit all of those things with captured identity on mobile and web. Secondly, capturing their intent and understanding it, and then mapping that intent to the right outcome, whether that outcome is a conversation or it's tooling that's available for self-service and beyond. Those are the ways that we're thinking about using AnswerBot Flows, mapping intent to outcome and allowing just a simple user with drag and drop, point and click, to create a really sophisticated bot that understands and can have conversations with users. And at the same time, using a capability called Switchboard, be able to move that conversation to a human, escalate to a human, and understand who's on point to respond, which I think is one of the challenges with the bot. Actually, it's like there's a human handoff, bot. There's a bot human handoff and a human bot handoff that need to be understood to track who's running the conversation, what conversation looks like. Those areas, huge investment, incredibly exciting. The second persona though, that's incredibly important is obviously the agent. AI can do a few things and automation can do a few things to make agents more productive and more powerful. Firstly, you know, we recently launched a feature called macro suggestion. So a macro is a canned response. And, you know, in a given customer service implementation, there's, you know, 50 to a few hundred things that happen. And in a good implementation, you're going to have responses canned so that agents can pull from the list and use that, right? The return to manufacturer response, the change password response, the alter user address response, these kind of things, product not working response. And so AI can actually look at the input, look at what's going on with this user, their identity, and then say to the agent, it is one of these three things, right? You know, some of our implementations have thousands of canned responses, thousands of macros that are used, you know, different cities, different locations, different ways of grouping, et cetera, et cetera. But artificial intelligence can pull immediately the right response, right? That lowers the training burden for agents, you know, because they learn and get this sort of reinforced learning from suggestion. And it also increases the productivity of agents dramatically. And so it's this kind of agent assistance, right, where suggestions are coming in, you know, from knowledge, from standard operating procedure that's documented, you know, where there's an extra alert or awareness about this customer, the type of customer it is, and these kind of things. It's all context sensitive. I think here there's a ton of just really interesting work that can be done that can change the amount of input that's required to run customer service implementation. And then I think what we see the best companies doing, and this is not just kind of Four Seasons high-end concierge experiences, it's branching out through the industry where people are recognizing that it's so much easier to build your business with by increasing the lifetime value of customers, by keeping customers and keeping them, having them repeat and not churn. I think what we're seeing is people really focusing on creating better human interactive experiences focused on the right things, right? You don't have to necessarily have the conversation around the return. you might want to be doing churn prevention through that conversation, or applying the agent population that you have to the most important conversations that you can identify, and AI can help you escalate to.
Yeah, you know, one of the most important things is when you build functionalities like this, you know, do you prefer to acquire them or build them yourself? You know, what's your philosophy when you go about making these changes?
You know, build by partner, it's sort of the classic description that you have. As I mentioned, we did a build of chat, and then we realized we wanted to move way faster, right? So you're buying IP and you're buying time when you make an acquisition. As software engineers and software companies, we like to think we can do anything. We just can't do everything. And we certainly can't do it on time. And so we acquired a chat company that helped us move forward with that. We partnered for, you know, say voice capabilities with our friends and a customer and partner at Twilio. And when we looked at the evolution of the market into messaging, I think once again, we wanted to be buyers of both time, IP, and most importantly, the team, right? I think one of the things you get when you acquire something of a certain size is you get the collective knowledge, all of the people who have 10,000 hours in this part of the industry. You get the DNA of that organization, and it comes into your organization and it can change it, right? Great acquisitions to me feel like cultural takeovers, right? Where the smaller companies thinking that a view of the world can begin to dominate the conversation within your own research organization, within your own company, and you can take and morph the core product and change it completely. And, you know, our acquisition of Smooch, the CPaaS, did that, where it turned us into a conversation first platform. It forced us to, I think, really up our game as an omni-channel conversation first contact center. And it, you know, super refreshing and super transformative. I think that's the best way to make acquisitions when you need to do that. I think also there's a lot to be said for build. The advantage of building is it's on your platform, right? Your enterprise customers, they're looking for all of the pieces of your product to obey the same terms and conditions, be hosted in the same way. You only want to have one conversation with the CISO. And I think build can really help you with that. Otherwise, when you acquire, you have to transition things into that. And so it's a complicated thing. And we've acquired in Singapore, Montreal, San Francisco, Montpellier. And I think you also have to, when you acquire teams in many locations, you have to be ready to put in the miles to onboard those teams and bring them in, and be ready to sort of embrace their culture, but make sure that, you know, your standards, your culture are also enforced, and the company will not be the same after the acquisition. So it's a big step.
So two of the major, you know, I guess trends that we hear about a lot is, one is the, you know, the low code, no code concept. And the second one is on the metaverse. You know, how are you thinking about it, your product portfolio as the tech expert within Zendesk, about how your products may be, you know, changed down the road because of some of these trends?
Yeah, I think we are very conscious and think a lot about low code, right? As SMB products tend to be configure first, right? I talked about the feature that we built, Answerbot Flows. It's flexible. It has APIs. You can plug things in. But at the same time, for the plurality of Zendesk customers, it's important that it is a no-code environment. Zendesk shipped with a feature called Triggers, which is a way of implementing business rules and workflow. And out of the box, there were 8 triggers and automation that sort of told you how to do customer service. When an email comes in, send an email response that says, I got your email. Forward it to someone who will answer the email, let them know it happens, etc. You know, this workflow was implemented. I think over the years, we've seen, as we launch a feature, there needs to be a low code and a high code version. And I think if you can do that, and I think, you know, the secret sauce for enterprise software sometimes is to take line of business specialists, whether it's in customer service or sales operations or whatever it is, and turn them into citizen developers with sort of the power to unlock, you know, their own use cases within your product and power those, right? You know, composability is the compound interest of software development or of software usage, right? And it's, you know, it's the multiplying factor of every line of code that you write. So letting your users compose things in different ways, whether that's first party things you built or third party through the integrations you enable, I think you unlock a huge amount of potential. And I think the bar for expectations has been raised, where I think more and more buyers of software expect to be able to configure themselves and expect to be able to configure in very powerful ways. So it's a big area of investment for us, and we'll continue to do so because we have a huge SMB and commercial implementation, but we also have, you know, as we think about moving into business, the business to employee space or beyond, we have a lot of admins in organizations who struggle to get the attention of software developers, right? There's a developer shortage, right? There'll be, I think in the US by 2026, there'll be about 1.2 million software engineers that we need that are not available. Like, that is the projected shortage according to the Department of Trade, I think. And so the low code revolution is going to help bridge those skills and bridge that talent gap. You asked about a second area of innovation, and I'm blanking on what it was.
The metaverse. The metaverse.
Yeah. I think the metaverse is going to transform or accelerate the transformation towards digital for many, many companies, right? It's a space. It's a digital space. It's a place where things are going to be. It's a marketplace. It's beyond. But mostly, it's a place where you meet your customers, right? And if we think about the channels that companies are introducing right now and the digital presences that they have, they're moving their storefront into the digital arena from, you know, putting the phone number on the website or meeting people in the corner shop and selling to them in that way. And the metaverse is just the next generation of that from a CX point of view. What's important when you move into a new channel, a new modality, is that service, like the other parts of your business, the other parts of the experience or the transaction, happens in that moment, in that experience, in a natural and authentic way, right? Our gaming customers, you know, Riot and beyond, Epic, they're thinking a lot about the metaverse and they're thinking about it, but they also already, you know, if you ask them about their core KPIs or their core metrics, it's to minimize in customer service, to minimize the disruption to playing time. They want gamers gaming. They want players playing. And any moments where that isn't happening is a disruption. So they need to minimize that. I think the same will be true of the metaverse. Any moment, you know, they're using more and more SDKs like our Unity SDK or others, and embedding the moments of customer service, the conversation of customer service into the gaming experience, right? From a theater point of view, right, they want to take the gamer and not basically break the Brechtian fourth wall of the experience where they take them out of it and say, okay, yeah, now you're going to talk to the audience. Now you're going to have this moment where you're getting service. Experience companies, entertainment companies don't want to do that. They want to keep it in the game. And I think we'll see with the metaverse, people keeping their customers in the metaverse for all experiences, including customer service.
You know, this has been an exciting session. We've learned quite a bit about Zendesk, about the future of technology and where things are moving. Just wanted to close out, but wanted to see if you had any final words for our listeners before wrapping it up.
You know, key things for us are we're excited to continue the journey towards innovation in customer service, keep growing our customer base, and keep sort of trying to show up and help people build the best customer experiences.
Great. Thanks, everybody. I look forward to another session in a couple of weeks. Thank you.